career, and in recent times he's been giving a lot of thought to not doing it all the time. That, in other words, your department obviously has a very difficult responsibility to tell the Mr. Honig how serious each individual case is. Am I correct? When you put a flyer out,
the high risk, the highest level of offender, that classification is actually comes from the California Department of Corrections. The local police agencies in California don't set that criteria. It comes from the state prison when they're released. And so there are very few of those. I mean, I suspect since the laws have been in effect, there's probably been under 10 that or less that have been published in any local paper. And I know that Mr. Honig has a different opinion about this, and it's a broader opinion about whether sex offenders can be held after their sentence on a civil commitment, which is a whole other topic. But he has, strong opinions about this. But, this is one that we obviously, I strongly disagree with him.
Well, Sheriff Tracy, I'd like to ask you, what about someone, say, that's been incarcerated and the person, is then paroled and goes directly into a place like the Delancey Street Foundation in San Francisco with a two-year commitment, and then they're, according to Mimi Silbert or, all the people running Delancey Street, the person is totally rehabilitated. Do you believe after that point that if the person, say, was a sex offender, that if the person then moves into a neighborhood, in this case, even if the person, say, moves into Santa Cruz County, then you have another tough decision, right? Is the person totally rehabilitated?
If they were a high-risk offender, categorized as a high-risk offender, we would do the notification. And so I think that certainly we all hope that a person could be rehabilitated and that a person would, through treatment, would not commit a crime again. But I think what the legislators who have put this together and put these laws and the courts that have upheld them are saying that in this situation, that the rights of the entire community outweigh the rights of a convicted felon. And so that's a decision they're making, and certainly so law enforcement is, taking the steps to follow those laws, and we would do the notification. What we've also found, though, that some of the notifications we've done, if the offender goes about their life, seeks employment, there is not an ongoing interest about that case, then it kind of goes away if the person is conducting their life in a legal manner and not creating a problem. So certainly they do have to suffer the consequences of the crime, and they may have to contend with that for many, many years. But we also find other offenders who have committed sex crimes who become rehabilitated and who in the future go back to a normal life and aren't the subject of this kind of scrutiny on a daily basis.
Sheriff, would like to ask you about the other story we discussed, the lead story in the Wednesday, May 7th Santa Cruz Sentinel, with a headline that said, Sheriff targets drunks in the emergency room. Subhead said solutions include more jail sentences. The byline journalist in this case was Jeannie Ann Harlick, and under the cut line under your photo says, Sheriff Tracy wants tougher penalties for public intoxication. Would you talk about that a little bit? Do you feel that the story in the Sentinel was A, accurate, good journalism? B, do you believe it was that important that it should have been the lead story that morning in the Sentinel?
Well, I do believe it's accurate, and I've been working with the health services director, with physicians from Dominican Hospital, from people from the American Medical Response Ambulance Company, and trying to address the issue of public inebriance in a number of areas. One is that many people are picked up off the street and taken to Dominican Hospital. The same people may be taking ambulance rides to the Dominican Hospital six, seven, eight times a month. The same holds true that the same people may be picked up by police departments or the sheriff's department and taken to the county jail where they're booked and released 6-7 times a month. All of this is at great expense to the county or the hospitals, and it really doesn't help the person who has the issue with alcohol. And so what we're trying to propose here is we think if people are, I personally believe that they're incarcerated for a longer period of time, they're better able to avail themselves of programs that are available at our facility in Watsonville that we operate. There are
the Honor Farm. You
the
talked
Honor
to
Farm.
Me.
There are drug and alcohol classes there. We're starting one of the first full-on drug treatment programs, drug and alcohol treatments that run 7 days a week with counselors. And so, if a person is able to become clean and sober, then they can maybe make a decision about entering a recovery. So that is, it's not just to put them in jail and let them sit there. We're offering them opportunities to deal with their addiction while they're in custody, and we would also be looking, as they came out of custody, how they could transition into some other opportunity, whether it was Alcohol Anonymous or some way that they could not return to the street and be, you know, the public inebriant life.
You're listening to Sheriff Mark Tracy on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. Sheriff Tracy, what are the number of alcoholics compared to the number of facilities? Is there a problem there?
Actually, I can barely hear you. So you said the number of alcoholics or the number of facilities?
Yes.
Well, there is bed space in our facility in Watsonville for public inebriants, and there are programs available there. So we would be able to manage additional people, and I think it would be better for the actual person who we're talking about, many of which, and I've heard the complaint before from the community, who because the agencies aren't working to address this issue, end up dying out on the street. And part of this is trying to put some system in place where the person has some other opportunity in their life and doesn't become another statistic out in the street.
If an individual wants to go into an alcohol program who isn't, let's say, incarcerated, is there the kind of waiting list, let's say, a heroin addict faces?
Well, I will be frank with you. Most people who are public inebriates don't want to go into an alcohol program. And most people who are thinking more about where the next drink's going to come that day aren't making rational decisions about their health problem, and they're thinking about making it through the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think we also have a responsibility to the community. It is not okay to have public inebriants in people's doorsteps and throughout the community, and it's a community problem. And so I know there may be disagreement with that, but that's certainly a big piece of this that needs to be addressed.
Sure, but for those who, let's say, do want to go into programs and who aren't incarcerated, what's the situation for them? Do you have any sense of that?
I do not have any sense that there are programs out there, a lot of them that are through Alcoholics Anonymous, various programs that are available. But what we find is that dealing with public inebriants and people that have this type of health problem is very difficult. And they don't necessarily self-select and on their own begin to go to programs. They need a period of time of sobering up. They need some attention to their diet, to their health care, so then they might be able to make a decision to then actively engage in treatment. And I think that's why the incarceration piece is important, because it gives them that time, introduces them to treatment programs and some options in their life. And then we plan to hopefully have an aftercare where they can continue that we point them in the direction of continuing in their sobriety.
You've been sheriff for about a decade now? Yourself?
8 years.
In your experience, has there been a change in this problem? Has it gotten worse? Has it gotten better? Has it stayed the same?
It's worse. I think it's worse.
And are we talking doubled, or do you have any sense on that?
It's always been there. It's always been a problem the community's wrestled with in terms of trying to develop sobering up facilities or what type of facility should be there, but I think lately it's gotten worse, and it I think last year we had over 2,000 bookings alone for public intoxication into the county jail, hundreds of admission, literally hundreds of admission to the emergency room at Dominican Hospital. And so I think it's reached a point where all the various agencies that are affected by this are coming together and saying, is there a better way that we can look at this? And I think we're doing it in terms of looking at what the community would work for the community, but also what would give the public inebriant or the person who's having this problem some better options in their life.
Are we talking about a younger population than a decade ago, or is it getting older, staying the same? Any sense on that?
I don't think it's real young. I think it's middle-aged to older, yes.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey has a question for you.
Yes. Sheriff Tracy, you probably saw the story last month. That it was a front-page story all over the country that a very famous former Major League Baseball player, Daryl Strawberry, born and raised in Los Angeles, that he said that when he was paroled, that he told the media that he was very happy that he was incarcerated after his long battle with cocaine and drug addiction, because he had tried all of these other programs. They sent him, the Dodgers sent him to a facility in Wickenburg, Arizona, etc. But bottom line, he is a role model, you know, to a lot of people, and he felt, hey, it's really important that I was sentenced to jail this time. Well, what's your take? I was kind of upset by that because, you know, I come from a place that people can be rehabilitated, and locking Mr. Strawberry up in a jail cell, I'll be surprised if he, you know, unless he keeps going to AA meetings or something, if he doesn't end up again situation at 44 years old.
Right, and certainly he certainly has an opinion about whether it was good for him or bad for him, and I don't know how he necessarily formed that opinion, so it's difficult for me to comment about what he said, but there are people that, for them, jail is a wake-up call, or it's a realization that they need to take steps to change our lives. Others, it isn't.
Right, but we're not talking, in this case, Sheriff Tracy, we're not talking about being at an honor farm like here in Marin right. County. He was actually saying it was important that he be put behind bars and for him to finally break his own cycle of pain.
Yeah, and I you know, certainly that's something that he's saying, you know, I don't doubt his sincerity, but I would agree with what you said, that his addictive behaviors are going to be a lifelong struggle for him, just like they are for many people that have addictions. And so, you know, will he be successful? Will it prove out that he was right? I think, just like you said, we'll have to wait and see.
Sheriff Tracy, in terms of the programs that you have available for prisoners, they've been going on presumably for the last 8 years while you've been a sheriff. But also, have you got any stats on the success? In other words, what's the recidivism situation in terms of folks entering those programs?
There's various programs that some have come, some have gone, and so there's various success levels of certain programs. And I think, like, even the way that the juvenile justice system, the probation department, and others look at this now, sometimes with addiction, and they even look at it now in terms of drug court. People who have addiction and addictive behaviors are going to have relapses. And so I think what we look for now is probably the length between times that people may have a relapse. Is it longer than it might have been before? Have they done well for a long period of time and then they may have a relapse, which they have to go back into treatment? And so I think in the criminal justice world, and I think that they're not being honest if they say they have some magic pill or one class or one method which will then solve a person's addictive behavior for life. In reference to your specific question, we do have a recidivism problem in correctional facilities, and we do see a lot of the men that are facility in Watsonville that do come back. But what we've seen is that they don't come back quite as often or quite as soon, and there are numbers of them that we do not see again. But these addictive behaviors are very powerful, and sadly we will see people coming back.
The reason I ask that is that it's kind of traditional wisdom in some circles that in order to give up an addiction, to some extent you have to voluntarily enter into a contract, and it's a difficult contract to make, to give up that addiction, that simply kind of depriving the person of alcohol in jail or the heroin, whatever, isn't going to do the trick. What's your sense on that?
Well, I think that drugs are available in jail also, and that, sadly enough. And, you know, I'm not an expert on treatment, and I think, like Daryl Strawberry said, different things work for different people. And there are people that are able to go into out-of-custody treatment programs and do well. Others flee. We see it constantly, that people go into out-of-custody treatment programs and run away. Then eventually, even though they're brought back, put into a program again, they run away again. And so if they're not there long enough to make that realization, then they really aren't helping themselves. So nationally, people are starting to look at in-custody treatment programs. We're one of three counties in California awarded a grant. There's a number of state prisons now that are very intense. And these are a group of men that will be isolated from the rest of the population with full-time counselors that will be in a treatment program. And so, you know, we hope that this has some effect on them, but I think it's also important as they leave the facility that they're, because that's the real test, is can they make it on the outside without the structure of the correctional facility. And so to do that, we have an aftercare program that we're working with the probation department to make sure that they can make that transition back into the community and continue their treatment.
Sheriff Tracy, wanted to ask you, last Thursday night we had a recovering heroin addict here in the studio, and he was talking about the laws prior to 1920 where heroin was legal in the United States. If you went to a doctor and he wrote out a prescription, you know, you could get your heroin. And now in Switzerland, they have these, as Robert pointed out, they have these rooms, injection rooms, like we have cigar rooms in Santa Monica or whatever, where you literally can go and receive your injection. The thing I wanted to ask you in law enforcement, what is your take in all the years you've been in law enforcement? Do you think that our culture might be better off if we at some point legalize all drugs or decriminalize them? And could you tell us for our listeners the difference between legalizing all drugs versus decriminalizing them?
Well, to me it's somewhat the same, but I think that the simple way I would put this, I'd make the correlation to alcohol. You know, in the 20s we had prohibition and would not allow alcohol. And, you know, people became a crime, and people, you know, committed crimes quite often because they wanted to get alcohol. And so then it was repealed. But today, the use of alcohol and alcoholism is one of the biggest issues in terms of addictive behaviors we have in the United States. And if that translates to drunk drivers, to injuries, to domestic violence. So for local police agencies, the fact that a drug or alcohol is legal has not reduced our criminal justice problems. In fact, alcohol remains one of the biggest criminal justice problems, you know, that we confront on a daily basis or have to deal with. And so, you know, I'm not convinced that if we were to legalize drugs, narcotics, you know, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, which is a terrible drug that has ruined people's lives and drug addicted children. And so I'm not convinced that a legalization process would better society and improve you know, people's health and their lives. And so at this time, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion around this issue, and people point at different countries and Canada and others of what the things they've done. But from what I've seen in my career, I'm not in favor of that of legalization.
Sheriff Tracy, we've had several advocates for medical marijuana, indeed care providers for medical marijuana, on the show. And I guess one of the concerns that has been brought up is their concern that this county, like Sonoma County, established guidelines in terms of the number of plants that people who are using marijuana or caretakers who are providing marijuana can have, so that they don't run afoul of local authorities. Because while it's most of the publicity has gone to the federal raids, which I think you may join me in deploring, I don't know, it certainly is widely deplored, the attacks on Valerie Corral and Mike Corral and their use of medical marijuana by the feds, they're much more widespread problem is, at least it's come to my attention, is a local seizures of marijuana, because there's sort of confusion as to how much is allowed. Would you be interested in setting up guidelines? What's your feeling around that?
Well, actually, that topic's already been dealt with at the Board of Supervisors, and I've worked very closely with Valerie Corral around this issue and the WAM Board of Directors, and the decision that was made independently and collectively by all of us was to not set plant guidelines in this county, and to look at each case on its individual merits. And so far, we believe that's been successful. Counties that have set plant guidelines may in fact hurt people and organizations like WAM, who are growing medical marijuana for their patients. And so that decision was discussed, brought before the supervisors, and it was collectively decided by the board, by WAM, and others who were interested in this, that it would not serve all the parties. And as long as there was open lines of communication, which I've continued with the WAM Board of Directors, and that there, it seems to be working as best it can at this time. You know, as we all know, the 215 did not necessarily answer all the questions about this, so there's a lot open to interpretation. Hopefully someday the state legislators or others will come in and clarify what it still is a complicated issue.
Actually, Supervisor Wormhout, when speaking to several care providers and myself, said that one of the prime concerns that she had was that the Sheriff's Department, namely you, were opposed to guidelines. It wasn't so much the corrals necessarily, but that you had a particular objection to them, and that if those of us who are interested in persuading you otherwise should speak to you and perhaps bring up the experience of Sonoma County. Is this something you're open to discussion on, or
no? Because I already did discuss it with the group, and we reached a decision. And I think that's a sound decision, and I think it's currently working. And you're right, I was against setting guidelines, but I also got the same feedback that might not work for care providers, and so that's where we left it.
And care providers you talked to, other than the corrals, did you talk to the other providers?
It was discussed openly at a Board of Supervisors meeting where everybody had an opportunity to speak to it.
Yeah, I understand that some of them showed up late, but yeah, I know it's still an open issue, the number of people, and that's why I raise it with you.
Well, I think there'll be open issues around 215 for years to come, and I know I sat on a committee with Senator Vasconcellos in Sacramento, where we were trying to write clarifying language, and there on that committee we had members of the California Medical Association, members from various medical marijuana groups, and so I think there was and still continues to be an effort out there to try to clarify these issues statewide, and you know, I think I've shown my willingness and my interest, and that will continue to come about on my behalf to try to answer some of these questions. So I don't think anybody can question my commitment to trying to work with the community on this. It's one topic the community is very interested in, and it's going to continue to be debated and discussed and for quite some time.
Well, I know that a lot of folks are concerned that the clubs that were legal or tolerated during the 90s that served 2,000 to 3,000 medical marijuana patients have now been forced to close down, and what we have is WAM, which, you know, it does a good job for 250 people, but what about the rest? That's the concern.
Well, the law allows for other people, too, and so WAM is just one of the organizations. It's one that's very, because of their activity around working with the legislators and the media, that they're obviously well-known and put a lot of work into this issue. But there are others that are out there that are quietly doing this work, and that we don't even come encounter with or aren't. And so it's not a this is not a one agency show. I mean, there's many people in California that are using medical marijuana, and it and abiding by the California law.
Now, coming up on the supervisor's agenda is a proposed ID card, which is supported by some medical marijuana users, opposed by others. But one question that came up when it was discussed was, would you be favoring a proposal, since I think your input is considered important on this issue, that would, shall we say, allow those without ID cards but with letters of recommendation?
County is only if a person wants to participate. So 215 doesn't require the ID card. It's just it's something if a person wants to do that, and if they have to present it or show it to somebody, that's their choice. And if that can help them to get on with their life and show that they're a medical marijuana patient, that would probably be a good thing. If people want to present a doctor's recommendation, that's also a legal way of showing under 215 that they're a medical marijuana patient. And so both of those are valid ways. And so I don't think that we would, if the county enacts through the health department this ID card, that's just, that's something that if people want to voluntarily use that they can. I mean,
right. So you don't think there'd be any, a person with only a letter would not be given a special scrutiny?
No, I think that I think like anything, it's the circumstances of the situation. I mean, I think a person who has a letter that conforms to the law, a person who has an ID card, I think that helps them to show that they're a patient also. So both are ways that a patient can show that they have the permission or the doctor's recommendation for medical marijuana.
Sheriff Tracy, wanted to ask you something we had discussed in the past as well. As we all know, Memorial Day weekend is coming up, and that means the start of summer here, and people will be going camping, etc. Would you talk about your thoughts in light of the fact that we, according to the head of the Department of Public Social Services, who I talked to about 6 weeks ago up in Emmeline, we have well over 10,000 homeless people in her computer who have been declared legally homeless by the County of Santa Cruz. And she told me that she's never seen economic conditions as bad in her whole career. She said, Jeffrey, she said, we can't even interview anyone until the middle of June if they need cash, general relief. In other words, can't even have an interview. We can help them get free food. We can help them get free clothing. But the bottom line, she said, every 24 hours, 100 more people are becoming homeless in Santa Cruz County. So could you talk a little bit, Sheriff Tracy, that makes your job really increasingly difficult with the fact that everyone, as she said, loves to hang out in Santa Cruz. It's beautiful. And what can we do in the United States where we have more than 8 million homeless people, if you read the definition in the 800-page book published by the University of Chicago Press on the origins of homelessness? We have more than 8 million, meaning if you don't have a first month's rent, you don't have a last month's rent,
you don't have
a security.
Let me see if I can help
what
you with
can
that.
We do
Jeffrey,
to help the homeless?
First of all, I'm gonna have to answer this, and then I'm going to have to say goodnight because I have another thing, a dinner engagement that I'm leaving to go to. But as you know, the homeless population can't be categorized as one single group. I mean, there are people that are temporarily homeless for whatever circumstances. There are people who have serious drug and alcohol problems who are homeless. There are some who choose to be homeless. There are some who have mental health problems who are homeless. And there's some just by pure economic circumstances are homeless. So when you talk obviously about people who are homeless, there is no one answer, because the population of homeless people is made up of very different types of people. Women with children might need different types of services and help, other than single white males who, as we talked before, who are public inebriants. And so I would agree with whoever, you know, from Human Resources Agency. I'm not quite sure if I know her numbers, or, you know, I can only believe that she, you know, has statistical numbers that are correct. But it is a tough time because of budget cutbacks, less money available at the state and federal level to address some of these problems. But I guess I would say is that I think for all the agencies in Santa Cruz County, we recognize that there's, you know, not one single type of homeless person. I mean, and that's why we, whether or not we're talking about dealing with public inebriants or trying to deal better with people who have mental health issues who become homeless. Recently, you know, for 3 years, the sheriffs in the state of California were able to get a grant put together keep and try to deal with mental health patients who found themselves in the criminal justice system. And that grant tried to work with mental health patients to keep them out of the criminal justice system. So each one of these situations requires somewhat of a different response. But it is, I agree with her, it's a tough time and there's not a lot of money to go around. And so it's going to continue to be tough here for a while in addressing some of these issues and helping some of these people.
Sheriff Tracy, much thanks for spending twice as much time as you said you were going to.
All righty.
Good luck.
All right. Thank you for letting me speak tonight.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. That was Sheriff Mark Tracy, again, lured to our station by the nightingale tones of Jeffrey Gale, who apparently buttonholes these people on the street and hauls them in like fish in a net. I did softballing on these interviews with Sheriff Tracy because I was afraid I would scare him away, frankly. We got an incoming call here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
You get all the good interviews.
Hey, how you doing there, Ray?
All the killer interviews, man. You get the cops, you get the mayor, you get everybody.
You get
calling
Jeffrey Gale on your show, man. He'll drag him in, he'll rope him in, he'll lure him in.
I wouldn't mind talking to the sheriff there, but unfortunately, it's only a one-line phone.
Yeah, that's one of the problems we have in the studio. And as I said, I wasn't really as candid as I want to be. I would say, maybe it's unfair to him, and I suppose I should provide him with a tape of this show, or when I speak about him. I'm quite critical of Sheriff Tracy on a number of points, and
but I think you handled the interview quite well.
Well, I did in the sense that he stayed on the line, but, you know, I don't think that he was confronted with the fact that he engaged in these discussions with Valerie Corral that, in essence, sort of excluded other parties. I mean, It's true that it was supposedly brought up the supervisors, but the people who were other than Corral, who were the care providers, who wanted the guidelines, who wanted the sheriff's deputies to stop taking people in for having their medical marijuana, and for them to have clear guidelines.
Yeah.
They didn't wait for the they rushed the item. Corral pushed the item at 9 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock, and by the time the rest of the care providers showed up, it had all been done. So, you know, and this is, I didn't confront Tracy with this. It wasn't his fault, of course. But the fact of the matter is, it was an unfair process, and it gives preeminent position to one woman's organization, which serves a very small minority of the medical marijuana people in this community, while the rest have to suffer either in silence or go underground. That's what happens. I didn't bring that up. So I wish, you know, I mean, I brought it up sort of, you know, a little bit softball, but yeah. I'm glad that we got him on the air. I mean, glad that he made some of these comments on the public record. I mean, also, I think it's a preposterous plan to start criminalizing inebriates and drunks more, as he wants to do. And he gave us these shifty answers about, he gave us no hard stats about recidivism. He gave us no hard stats about, you know, how many facilities are there? How many people go into them, you know, outside of the facility, how many go into the inside, how many are successful. You know, none of this was very clear in anything he said. He's just using your usual police call for more controls kind of approach. And
yeah, but he's a politician. What do you expect,
though? He's the sheriff of our community. He's an elected official. He's a man of some intelligence and experience.
He may be of some intelligence, but isn't he trying to climb a political ladder? I mean, come
on. I don't
know.
I don't know what his ambitions are, and I don't want to second-guess him, but I am concerned. What I'm not really criticizing him, although of course I am, but I'm criticizing my own, you know, the reason you said you were glad I interviewed him. He didn't.
Yeah, I am glad you interviewed him, because someone has to.
He didn't get a real interview from me. He got the softball, and the reason he got the softball was because I don't think he would stay for the hardball, frankly.
You should have hardballed him about any question you wanted to. I only heard the medical cannabis thing, but what about the rest of it?
Well, the problem is...
Why couldn't you have hardballed him about some other stuff?
I didn't invite him into the studio, and when he heard my voice on the air, he didn't want to answer any questions from me. Remember that, Jeffrey?
Yeah, indeed.
He didn't want to say a word to me, so I, in essence, had to kind of finesse it. Mark Tracy and I have had an adversarial relationship for quite a long time.
I don't think I have an adversarial relationship with a dude. I haven't. I only met the dude once, but...
Well, I have an adversarial relationship because of his policies. I mean, we can go back to the abuse of a 59-year-old medical marijuana user back in the late 90s. We can talk about covering up for Sergeant Deverell and other officers. We can talk about, again, the policy of ignoring medical marijuana users throughout the county. I'm skeptical of bureaucrats and officials generally, and I tend to be... You know, I tend to be hard on them if they don't make themselves publicly accessible. I want to, however, take off my hat to Tracy that he at least came on the air. I don't think he knew it was on my show. I'm pretty almost positive he wouldn't have come on if he knew it were my show. He didn't tell him it was my show, did he, Jeffrey?
Of course not.
Of course not, yeah.
Mary Emily Riley, she said for sure, Robert, she would not be on your show.
Right. Sorry, what was that, Renita?
So that was kind of a sneaky thing for you guys to do.
I didn't do it. I take no responsibility. I would tell Tracy it's my show. I wouldn't bushwhack anybody. And frankly, that's why I didn't hardball him,
Because you didn't think he knew?
Because I didn't think he'd stay. And I also wanted to give Jeffrey the opportunity to get answered the questions he had. I think it was quite a coup that Jeffrey was able to persuade Mark to come on the air. Mark usually comes onto the air in these kind of... non-controversial forums. This is the very opposite of a non-controversial.
Well, what else did you talk about besides this? Because
we talked about his sex life. We didn't talk about any of that. We talked about proposal. Well, we'll talk about it later because I don't want to repeat the whole conversation we had. This is not a private phone call. You're on the air. You got any questions you want to ask or other comments?
Just that I thought you did a pretty good interview with Mr. Tracy there, and I hope he. Does what he says he's going to do as far as, you know, the good things that he says he's going to do.
Don't hold your breath.
I have my doubts.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Romito. You have a thought, Jeffrey?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, the bottom line is he did come on the show. He told me a long time ago that you know, we had had a long conversation, that he was willing to be interviewed on the radio. I think that you did well, Robert, having Mike Rotkin here in the studio, recovering heroin addicts here in the studio, and I can't wait, Robert, until you get Congressperson Sam Farr here in the studio, maybe Memorial Day weekend with Dennis Kucinich, and see if we can get that gentleman from Carmel to understand that he's been backsliding, dealing with getting out and pushing for Kucinich to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. That would be fantastic. Well, you can have Emily Riley come in here and bring some of her goodies, baked goodies, and we can have an interesting Memorial Day weekend right here in the studio.
Emily will look forward to that. You tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Jeffrey Gale is my name-dropping co-host in the studio with me, but not only does he drop names, he gets names to call in, so I can't complain about that. Stay with us. ¶¶ Favorites, Masturbate and Smash the State by, of course, Just Kiddin'. I haven't heard them singing that song in goodness knows how many years. We may have to get them in the studio to give a demonstration.
This is National Masturbation Month, May, of course, right? You realize.
Masturbation, no, this is Mating Month. Let's get together. I guess you can mutually masturbate. But, let the joy overflow, as we say. And let the joy overflow in free radio at 96.3 FM. We also broadcast on the web at www.freakradio, F-R-E-A-K-R-A-D-I-O. Yeah, that's a change of website address for those of you who are interested. But you can still use the old one, Micro Radio, in case you haven't got the new one. You know, it'll switch over to that. It's www.freakradio.org. And that's the... We stream on that website. That's the website we stream on. You can also catch our voicemail at 427-4523-831 is the area code if you're calling us from Sydney, Australia. And you can also catch us at Snail Mail, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Please make all checks payable to Free Radio Santa Cruz or Robert Norse, N-O-R, no, just kidding. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz, F-R-S-C. You can also make checks, of course, available to me, but actually I'm not soliciting money for myself. I am soliciting money for Free Radio, also old equipment, PSAs, questions. questions, you want a show of your own, you think you've got something you want to put out there, please give a call. 427-4523 is the voicemail. And you can reach the studio now at 427-3772. If you give a call in, we can talk about, well, have any comments on what Sheriff Tracy has said? You can comment on that. Want to point out that, Jeffrey, you found out that there is a town hall meeting. You're kind of scooped me on that one coming up on the 20th. I guess that's Tuesday, what, 7 o'clock?
7 o'clock. The mayor announced it right at the city council meeting shortly after 7 o'clock the other night.
That's one of those city council meetings that I mercifully missed. Day before yesterday's city council meeting. Usually the second and fourth Tuesday of every month is the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. I did get a report on some of it from activist Becky Johnson, who wasn't there either, but she viewed it on the boob tube. And there were numerous things that I will give a report on, hopefully on Sunday. I'm afraid it's not going to be a very positive report. I think that ADU, accessory dwelling unit requirements, have been shaken up and loosened up a little bit, but still no amnesty for past ADUs. So there's still people who are living in those units are still can't complain about code violations without losing their housing entirely. Same problem as for the last decade. No change there. But those who want to build new ones can with more ease. I think if you're, 3 or 5 feet from the property line now, you can do a one-story garage conversion. If you are 30 feet, you can do a two-story conversion. There's more details, which hopefully I'll bring to your attention when that comes up. Hopefully maybe on Sunday I'll give you more details on that. And other things were passed at City Council, Becky Johnson's claim against the city for a false arrest when Mia Duquette, Parks and Rec employee, had her, struck her, and then had her arrested for chalking a pro-homeless statement on the gutter, not on the sidewalk, which would have been illegal under the police department's interpretation of the defacing the sidewalk law, but actually in the street, which is not illegal unless you think you can get a jury to convict you of vandalism for writing with erasable chalk a political message that's easily erasable. She was never taken to court. She was just taken to jail and held there till midnight on a $1,000 bail, all at the behest, essentially, something overseen by Sergeant Jim Lennon, with colluding information from Officer Wendy Bynes and false information, too, I might add, according to Becky Johnson's report. And this is has now been made a claim against the city, and the city has, of course, I'm sure rejected that claim. I wasn't at the city council meeting, but I can't imagine they would accept it. It's for, I think it's $70,000 Becky's trying to get as in damages. And it will then go, if Becky has the resources, interest, and support to carry it further, into the court system, where apparently the... It's a sad situation when you have to look to the courts for justice, and it's kind of hard to find it there. You have to be able to pay for it, and you get the kind of justice you pay for in these courts. But Becky was able to get $10,000 from the LAPD after they struck her with a baton, and essentially causing her to fall down on the sidewalk in the middle of the police riot for the Democratic National Convention in 2000. So she has been successful, and she's... I'm using actually the same attorney she used, who kind of stepped in. When they smell a successful case, they jump on board. I'm, as you may know, those of you regular listeners who have been tuned in, I'm suing the city of Santa Cruz and Sergeant Butchie Lauren Baker, as well as, I think, George Kovacevic, the assistant city attorney, is also on the lawsuit as a defendant. And in addition, Matisse Selman, the owner of Sushi Now, which, while it's moved from its kiosk, now occupied by, I guess it's Al Fresco, in front of New Leaf Market, he's still at the Metro Center, still serving sushi. And, you know, Matisse doesn't serve a bad sushi, and he's not a bad guy. He's just made some bad choices. Unfortunately, he's stuck by them, and the choices he made gentrified that area of the sidewalk and supported even worse choices by Alibaba of Alibaba's Cafe, who's now gone from the scene, at least as far as Alibaba's Cafe goes. That's been taken over by David of Cafe Campesino. And they seem to be a little looser there now. I sat down at a table without being harassed by either of the owners. I was told by Marilyn, who runs Alfresco, that she has a policy of allowing people to sit at the tables who aren't customers, provided they show some respect for people, for customer table space when that's needed. And I have respect for that. So I'm glad to see that. And I'm You know, I'm not rigid in my views, although I think the whole process of privatizing that sidewalk was disgraceful, and we're seeing it happen again at, in a way, well, actually, a similar kind of elimination of planter seating space. That's really what it was. That whole planter area in front of New Leaf, which used to be a place where people sat and socialized and hacky-sacked, and some people politically tabled, and some people just hung out, and other people chatted, and some people ate lunch. It wasn't the most middle-class scene. It was, you know, grungy in some respects at times, and there were complaints of different things. But in fact, it was part of the downtown scene, part of one of the three spaces for people to sit, and it was stolen away by the masters of gentrification. And in order to make sure it was stolen away, when we announced a boycott, people like Matisse Selman and Sergeant Baker colluded to essentially scrap the Constitution, in my case, have me and Zoe Einbinder arrested for tabling, politically tabling. And it's really important in these Ashcroftian times, with Smiley Riley as our mayor, nonetheless, however Smiley Riley is, not to have that happen. So that lawsuit is going into federal court. Actually, Matisse Selman has sent me a whole set of interrogatories that I am responding to. He wants the set of every free radio show from March to from January to March of 2002, which I suppose we will sell to him, and he will be able to listen to the commentary on his bad choices there. And by the way, sometimes Matisse Selman listens to the show, or used to. If you're listening in, and if you feel like calling in, you're welcome to call in. You're going to be allowed time to speak. We allow everyone time to speak on this show. Perhaps not as much time as everyone wants, but sometimes certainly. Emily Riley is going to let you all speak at a town hall meeting on Tuesday. You want to talk about that, Jeffrey?
Well, the mayor said that she was hopeful that at the town hall meeting in the Del Mar Theater Tuesday night, May 20th at 7 o'clock, there not being a city council meeting that night, that people who speak at the meeting would also, she was hopeful, say things about why they love living in Santa Cruz and the good things about Santa Cruz, in addition, of course, to criticisms that people will make. That night, unfortunately, there's another major event where a very fine professor of journalism, Con Hallinan, at the University of California at Santa Cruz, is going to be speaking at 7:30 on Soquel Avenue. I've got the address here, and it's going to be a really hard-hitting speech and a Q&A about the fact that the United States is becoming more and more of a police state. This Patriot Act number one is in. Now we're all trying to fight to not get Patriot Act number two in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, I'd like to tell the listeners that, you know, I've been talking to Tom Honig for quite a while about the Santa Cruz Sentinel running a weekly program listing of everything on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I would like to encourage people who listen to this show to call Tom Honig at 423-4242. He's the editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. The buck stops in his desk, and say, gee, you know, we've been listening to, you know, Robert's show and other shows for 8 years, and we noticed that you've got the community public access guide every day in the Sentinel, and we encourage you to please run once a week the guide so people will know what is on 96.3 FM, which in my opinion is the heart and soul of radio here in the city of Santa Cruz, California.
Give that number again, will you, Jeffrey?
Tom Honig, editor-in-chief of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. His phone number is 423-4242. And he said, Robert, that, you know, I asked him, it'd be great if he would come on this show live as a guest. He was out ill for quite a while, but I think he's going to do it.
Well, if you can get Mark Tracy, you might be able to get Tom Honig. But Sam Farr, I think, and again, of course, George Bush, that's probably a cut above your even your resources, Jeffrey. We'll see about...
What about Dennis Kucinich?
Dennis Kucinich would be good to have on the show, although, you know, he seems to speak pretty well without a radio show. What he says bears reading, and you can get him off the Internet. He speaks well. I don't need to have celebrities in the studio. I need to have people actually who aren't celebrities, who don't get a chance to speak, who aren't heard. And frankly, that's you out there, folks. So if you got access to a phone and you want to speak to me by phone, if you can't do it today, call from the Homeless Services Center phone. And do it there and give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you have instances of police misconduct or concerns about how social services are or are not being provided, or you just want to talk generally about what's right or what's wrong around how poor people are treated, I want to hear it. 423-HUFF, and we'll pass it on to the radio audience. But that's not to demean or derogate what you're doing, Jeffrey. I appreciate all that. And
well, it just so happens that the day you host this show on, I believe it's Sunday, May 25th, Congressperson Kucinich is going to be at a special event, two events. One in the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, where he will be one of the key speakers, along with the Reverend Marianne Williamson, who's flying in from the greater Detroit area, and John Robbins, who lives in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And then there's going to be an event immediately thereafter in the Veterans Building. So, Robert, since we know Kucinich is going to be spending that Sunday in Santa Cruz, California, I think it would be great to have him on your show.
Sure. Get him, line him up, and we'll herd him into the station and see what gives and what goes. You are tuned, of course, to Free Radio, and if you want to call in, we have an open line. I'm right now kind of scanning the computer here in search of a couple of announcements. There was a story in today's paper, which was quite... It was actually yesterday's paper, yesterday's Santa Cruz Sentinel, which was rather depressing and actually confirmed information that some of us had gotten, gosh, months ago. I'd heard about it months ago. It showed up in interviews some time ago, and it was, well, here's the article. City says planter a magnet for trouble, devises railing plan by Dan White. Sentinel staff writer Santa Cruz. The planter near Costa Brava restaurant is more than an oasis for tired rear ends. City staffers declaring the planter a magnet for drug dealers, sexual harassers, and obnoxious drunks have decided to install a new railing that will block people from sitting on it. The railing plan recalls last year's brouhaha over the so-called hippie planter in front of New Leaf Community Market, also on Pacific Avenue. A railing already lines the Costa Brava planter, but it is set back enough to form a ledge for resting rumps, as it is with every waist-high planter up and down the mall. But you see, those are the focal point for elimination by the gentrification masters, who simply want to get rid of a certain, quote, element in town and don't care if they deny everybody seating to do it. Moving right along. The new railing would block sitters. Assistant City Manager Martine Bernal said the City Manager, Police Chief, and Parks and Recreation staff backed the project. He said the railing does not require a council vote because the current railing is old and rusty and a new version is basic maintenance. I haven't noticed that railing particularly old and rusty. Jeffrey, you've been downtown. You've seen the Costa Brava railing, the railing in front of the planter of the Costa Brava?
Yeah, not really. You know, we do have a lot of railings that have collapsed in California where people have died. One near UCLA recently that made a front-page story, a huge lawsuit involving millions
right,
of dollars.
But I don't think this kind of fits that definition.
No, not exactly.
Not exactly. Bernal, citing complaints from storekeepers and employees, said it's just incredible, the stuff going on, everything from harassment and loud noise to obnoxious drunk people and drug dealing. You might even argue that we took too long to respond. Of course, what's needed here is a Public Information Act request to Martine Bernal to specify just exactly what information is coming in and also some police reports on the complaints from that area and the nature of what's being done in terms of arrests. We're talking, no doubt, about things like criminals sitting, leaning against a railing. One fellow who now comes regularly, or actually irregularly, to Huff meetings, which happen every Wednesday at 8:30 in the morning at Baker's Square, for all of you folks who don't know, come on down. Free coffee. He was leaning against that railing, which is, again, about waist high. Police came and told him that he was sitting on it. He said, you can't sit on the railing, so he got off the railing and leaned on it, and they gave him a ticket for leaning. And then he took it to court, went through the process of disqualifying referee Mulligan, always a good idea for those of you who are fighting infraction tickets. For more information, call 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And he... The police didn't show up, of course, because leaning against a railing is not a crime, but it's perfectly okay to harass someone with tickets, whether it's Becky Johnson with an arrest where she's held till midnight in a drunk tank, or another individual who stands up to the false authority of police officers who should be doing better things with their time and with their power. Well, what they're intending to do now, according to this article, of course, is set up a railing that makes it illegal to even sit. You can't sit on the sidewalk near there because, see, that's within 15 feet of a building. You can't sit on the railing because that's, quote, misuse of public property. In essence, it means go find yourself somewhere else to sit. This becomes a human-free zone, or let's say keep shopping, throw your money in the stores, and keep moving. Because I remind you, if you stand under a railing, I'm sorry, if you stand under an awning in the rain, as a magician CJ and his wife did, you will be told it's illegal to stand next to a store. That is what he said. Either a CSO Bachtel or Officer Wendy Bynes told him he was doing inappropriately, illegally, and moved him on. That's happened also to other people, like the very well-accomplished didgeridoo player who used to play in front of Eclectics. So there's just this complete devil-may-care attitude by the police who can kind of do what they want with people when they, I don't know whether they get orders from their sergeant in the morning to clear them all, or whether they're responding to specific complaints, or whether they just sort of are cocking their eye in their let's control the next group up here fashion, but they are engaging in even going beyond the rather expansive laws and codes that the city council voted last year and in January that criminalize essentially 95% of the sidewalk for sitting and for spare changing, peaceful spare changing and non-obstructive sitting, I want to point out, and that criminalize 75% of the sidewalk for political tabling and for playing music with a display device. So you've got trouble, my friend.
Well, of course, having studied in London many times, if you want to sit on a chair in a public park in London, you have to pay, Robert, to rent the chair before you can sit in it. Maybe in this little police state we have here, we all should, you know, pass a law here in Santa Cruz where, you know, you bring your chair with you and you pay a little, you know, 20 pence or whatever, and you sit on the Pacific Avenue Garden Mall and make sure that they fix the toilets in the metro, by the way, Robert. Finally, they realize, the city attorney and the folks realize that the men's room in the metro is unsanitary, and believe it or not, it's going to be totally rehabilitated. And I was wondering, when you mentioned about our sister Becky, whether the LAPD, you know, the whole situation where they used the same baton that they beat Rodney King with to beat Becky. Maybe she's listening now. We could try to figure that one out. It's the same, you know, Los Angeles County, et cetera.
Well,
right?
Becky, if you're listening, we want details on baton length. That wasn't exciting. Were there, you know, little studs on it? What color was it? And all these details. But I don't think, actually, she probably isn't listening. I believe it is her son's birthday today, actually, is what I heard. So she may be off celebrating or something to that effect. We do have an incoming call. Perhaps I'm speaking too soon. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello? You're on the air.
Hi, Robert.
Yo.
It's Yon.
Hey.
I can barely hear you.
Oh, go ahead. Can you hear me now?
That's better.
Go ahead.
I want to apologize for not getting to the Huff meeting, and I did set up the time for the workshop meeting room at the...
Right, you're live on the air, you understand.
Yeah, okay.
So we're talking to Yon Golder. That's the man that the city manager loves to hate. He's been enjoined, or by actually stipulation, from coming within how many yards of a city employee or office?
20 yards. Is it?
20 yards. You got to keep this man away. He is a weapon of mass distraction. He is also, I mean, I was there. I think I was there. I think I heard about it or I was there when you got hauled out of the library for what, walking in to check out a book or walking
in to read a book? Just going in there and studying.
You don't want to do too much studying. That could lead to other things. Could have been a terrorist incident being planned here. Anyway, I know, Jan, that you and Huff are planning a forum on legally assisting people with some various infraction tickets, kind of giving workshops. I don't know how well that's going to sell, because I know that the people who are given tickets for chalking and for sleeping at the peace vigil still don't seem to be wanting to get any assistance. They haven't showed up at Huff meetings, and they don't seem to be interested. But if any of them are listening, they might want to show up at the next Huff meeting or call 423-HUFF and be a part of this process.
Yeah, we're trying to tell everybody, Robert, that we're going to do this as a trial workshop to see who comes and what kind of questions they have and how involved they want to get into using the legal process to fight the law. It's not easy, but there's quite a few simple tricks that you can use.
Yeah, I hope we can go through those. And I know that you successfully buffaloed old Mulligan back into a corner even before you challenged him. You didn't even do a peremptory challenge where you said, "I want another judge." You said, "Mulligan, it seems to me, Your Honor, such as it is, that you have no right to hear any criminal cases whatsoever without the consent of the parties," right?
That's essentially what I'm alleging, and in fact, what I've done now, since he declined to rule on the motion, he just ignored it, is I've written a letter to Presiding Judge Mike Barton and asked him specific questions about Mr. Mulligan's authority.
Now, wait a minute. Is that beyond the 5 questions a month that court has ruled? This is great, folks.
Now, that's just
the court has stipulated that Jan here can only ask 5 questions each month, not verbally. He's not allowed to ask them verbally. He's not allowed to call up on the phone. He has to deliver them by email or fax or letter?
Email, letter, or fax, yeah.
And he can only have 5 questions. On the 6th, you're violating your court order there, Jan, so don't ask too many questions.
Well, Robert, now, that's just with the city of Santa Cruz. The court's a different entity, and I can go after them as many times as they want, of course, until they throw an injunction at me.
Well, Jan, this is Jeffrey Gale here. As you know, the Jews just celebrated Passover, and they only ask 4 questions at the Seder, you know. So you're at least getting to ask one more question than all the Jews in the world got to ask.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. So what are you complaining about, Jan? So,
well, I'm not complaining, actually, Robert. I'm telling you that I've fired another round, actually 2 more rounds of questions at the city, and there's some...
Now, if you come up with some interesting answers, I expect you to come in on Sunday and talk about them.
Maybe even on time this time, Robert.
Sure, you don't have to be on time. You just have to come so that there's enough time for us to be able to run through them. We have only about 35 minutes left, so we're going to have to kind of cut this one short. But
okay, well the time I've got, and this should work out, is 5:30 on Tuesday, June 10th.
What happens on 5:30 on June 10th is the tentative time for a library room usage?
A meeting in the upstairs library room, a workshop or seminar, if you will, on fighting infractions, dealing with the Santa Cruz Police Department. And
fight your infraction ticket June 10th at 5:30 for those of you who want to peek in on the process and talk to a master here who has been behind bars for 37 days, no less, last fall, but who is still plugging away. And you might even see him around town with a canoe on top of his truck. That's the telltale trademark of Jan Golder if you happen to be watching vehicles downtown. Anything else you want to say, Jan?
Well, that's just it. I encourage everybody who's listening who feels like it's hopeless to fight infractions and feels like the law is just too overwhelmingly complex to come to the workshop and see what we have to offer and see if that doesn't raise your hopes that we still have a constitution and we still have a fair process.
Well, now, I don't want to raise anybody's hopes either, but I'm always, frankly, encouraged when guys like yourself and women, too. I've seen women do good work as well, believe it or not. Hanging in there, it's hard for anybody to fight this court system, and when people have got the guts to do it, my hat's off to them, even though I don't have a hat. So there you have it.
All right, well, I'll catch you on the radio. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks a lot, Johan.
Bye.
So now's your big chance to call Free Radio. A line is open, 427-3772. I'm going to run to a couple of things here, which I don't usually get a chance to talk about. I was reading this story again about the city's plan to essentially make anti-homeless architecture downtown, which is to destroy seating space. This is done in San Francisco bus areas where they try to make sure homeless people don't lie down on the seats. Santa Cruz is doing them one better by making sure that they can't even sit down on the seats. You're going to have to just leave the area entirely or stand around. I guess you can stand around and smoke. How's that? That should be charming. I don't know about even that. I think there's a city smoking law. But here's the rest of the story. Bernal citing complaints from store owners and employees, and we're talking about the planter in front of Costa Brava, said it's just incredible, the stuff going around, everything from harassment and loud noises to obnoxious drunk people and drug dealing. You might even argue that we took too long to respond. Mike Tosney, a manager of nearby Rosie McCann's Irish Pub and Restaurant, said the drug dealing near the railing is out of hand. Of course, we're not talking about the alcohol drug dealing upstairs, which no doubt is perfectly well in hand. People try to use our restrooms to do drugs, he said. Tosney, however, had mixed feelings about the railing plan. He worries non-troublemakers will be inconvenienced. Opponents include activist Sherry Connable, who said the city has removed too many benches. In a letter to the city, she said, whenever a merchant or two perceive a problem outside their store, the street furniture gets removed. The plan also drew the ire of Tim Daly, a homeless man sitting on the planter Monday. Is it okay for people with houses to hang out here, but not okay for us to sit here for 10 seconds? It's a double standard.